Are you really good at what you do, but kind of awkward and uneasy when it comes to self-promotion? Maybe you struggle to find the right words, or you fear of coming across as an imposter. A radically distinct personal brand strategy clarifies the unique value you offer and gives you the confidence and courage to share your message with the world. Go to jenmorgan.com to learn about Jen's upcoming 2-day personal brand workshop. That's Jen with 2 N's, morgan.com. Registration is limited to 10 participants. Act now. Hello and welcome to Radically Distinct Radio. I'm your host, Jen Morgan. And if you've been liking our show, go on over to iTunes and rate and review the show. It really helps us out. Today on Radically Distinct Radio, we have Meredith Fishkin, who is a futurist and startup consultant. And we're going to talk about predictions, persuasion, and human behavior at a massive scale. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jen. It's nice to be here.
I am so happy you're here because I think that a futurist is such a different, I've never heard of that as a career title ever before, and I can't wait to find out more.
It's definitely one of the best career titles you can possibly get. Nobody knows what it means, and it's absolutely wonderful.
So tell me, what does it mean?
So a futurist is somebody who links together a bunch of small facts or a bunch of seemingly indifferent pieces of information, and they make a future prediction, right? So you can predict what's going to be in your refrigerator next week because you know what you like to eat, and that pickled herring in the back is just never going to get there. But I can do that on a much larger scale. For example, I'm working with the Port of Seattle, and I'm helping them predict the future cost of the Lower Duwamish cleanup. For those of you who don't know, the Lower Duwamish is a tributary from the Green River, and the last 5 miles of it is a Superfund site which runs into Puget Sound, and it holds about 700 different species of wildlife, including, I think, 5 or 6 different species of salmon. So okay, it's hugely important.
And you're trying to predict the cost of cleaning it up?
Predict the future cost of cleanup. So a Superfund site, something that takes a couple hundred years to clean up, it's not something that's going to be done overnight, but it is something that needs to get done, not just for our health, but for the health of the waterway and all of the animals living in it.
Mm-hmm. What happens if it doesn't get cleaned up?
So if we continue to contaminate it and then we don't clean it up, let me just first say, don't eat anything that comes out of it.
Okay.
But if that continues, it's likely to impact bald eagle lifespans. They eat fish out of the river. It'll kill them about 20 years faster than they would normally. We'll continue to see diminished rates in salmon, which brings down industry and also means we don't get to eat salmon.
Okay.
And it will kill off a lot of the herons, the frogs, and the indigenous species there. And it starts to smell.
Okay.
So you'll actually, if you go out on a really hot day in Seattle, which is like 85 degrees, I know, and you stand by the Duwamish, it actually smells bad. And that smell is because the particulates of contaminants are killing off the fish, the wildlife, the fauna, and it's decomposing and getting into your lungs. So the contaminants are getting in your lungs along with all the dead smell of everything else, and it just destroys the whole area.
Okay, and so when you predict the future cost of it, where do you even start?
So some of that is about predicting the future loss of revenue, right? So we predict things like salmon runs, whether or not you can fish out of there. We can predict things like who's going to go out of business, who polluted in that area, and who's going to have to pick up that cost. Is it going to cost more to do dredging, which is picking up the sediment dirt on the bottom of the river this year or in 10 years or 25 years? Or is it, you know, better and cheaper to wait 25 years and wait for a better technology to come out? Is it a good idea just to kind of dam up the shore and say, look, we know that's contaminated. We're just damming it up. We're going to repair it for 250 years until the contaminated soil kind of seeps out and the contaminants are low enough that we can let it back into the river and not worry so much about it?
Mm-hmm.
Or we say, no, really, we've got to do this absolutely now. There's no way we can contain this. It's going to kill off a whole bunch of people and it's going to destroy a bunch of stuff.
Okay.
And what we do is just predict all of those little tiny things and we add up all the numbers and then we go and talk to the deep pockets. And the deep pockets in this case include Boeing, who is really nice about giving money to cleanups, King County, Puget Sound, kind of utilities, so the energy and the water guys, and the Port of Seattle. And they all pool their money and they talk to the EPA, and the EPA kind of oversees and helps clean up that costing area.
Mm-hmm.
And then at some point, we're going to start talking to the smaller guys. And that includes every car company who's ever stored cars, anybody who's ever hosed down industry in that area. And it is an industrial area. It has been for 150 years.
Mm-hmm.
There are abandoned cranes there. They're beautiful. They're turning into rust. But they're still sitting out there, and they're falling into the water. We found cars, boats. We found a couple houses in the water.
What?
You can find amazing things, like just a couple of feet down, and sometimes not that far, where people just kind of let the boat sink and figured somebody else would clean it up and take care of it.
Okay.
And so some of it's a lot of guesswork about what you're going to find as well underneath.
And so do you, so your job is to provide the data to the people who go out and make those pitches, I guess? Or do you actually go out and make the pitches also?
I do a little bit of the pitching as well.
Mm-hmm.
My job is to kind of back the financial prediction.
Okay.
And we give those numbers in great detail to legal teams and to the EPA. And we kind of argue about it a lot, actually. So they have people who do what I do, and we fight back and forth with all the people who do what I do on our side and all the people who do what they do on their side about how much it's really going to cost and whether or not we really had to do it or really have to do it in the future.
So the logic behind your recommendation is incredibly important because you're going to be challenged from every angle.
Of course. There are some times where we say, well, that number isn't too important because we think that they're going to go after lower hanging fruit. But too important means only a page or two of defense instead of 10 or 20 pages worth of defense.
Okay. Interesting. Okay. So how does a person get into, like, when did you in your life decide I'm good at this prediction thing?
I was about 14 and I predicted Bebe, which many...
The
clothing store young people shop at. It was the first of the French designer companies to bring the product directly to the U.S. Even today, French designers modify the product for the U.S. business, and they give us kind of a crappy off-the-shelf version
mm-hmm.
of the stuff they design in France. But these guys came out and they said, no, we're just going to ship you exactly the same stuff we have, which meant that they were looking at U.S. sizes -1 to about 8, which is very skinny, very thin, very tall, French model-esque people. And they decided to put it in Bellevue Square, which even at the time had the highest price per square foot footage of any place to sell, any retail space. Incredibly high priced sales, people who had just massive amounts of expendable income and who were really that fashion-oriented. I looked at all of the different parameters. I saw that they were the first who were going to do their industry. I looked at where they were going and the expendable income, and I said, that's going to be important. People are going to spend money like never before, and they're going to come to Seattle to do that, or Bellevue anyway.
Like from around the United States?
From around the U.S. They
okay.
came to Bellevue Square to go to Bebe.
Uh-huh.
And I predicted it at about 53 cents a share. And I went to my mother.
Wait, you actually said the price is going to be 53 cents a share?
I said it is 53 cents a share. We need to buy this.
Okay.
And my mother did what every rational adult mother does to a 14-year-old who comes with a stock tip. She said, of course, honey, we'll totally buy that. That's not a problem. And about a year later, I came back and I said, oh, my God, you're never going to believe how high the price. And like, we're going to be millionaires. It's going to be awesome. How much did you put down? And she goes, oh, honey, I lied to you. And I said, but the price is $72 a share. We have to sell it. And she goes, oh, I didn't buy it.
Oh.
And it was just that moment when I thought, wow, I could have made millions of dollars. I am so awesome at this. And all it took was a couple hundred hours of research. I could do this again. And I was just, you know, you take a 15-year-old kid and you give them a high like that and you say, yeah, next time they're going to listen to you. And you go out and you do it again and again and again. And it's so much fun when you get a win, and manipulating the right information to get that win is really just a great high.
Interesting. Okay, and you, for those of you who don't know, Meredith's mother and her oldest brother, right? Your oldest brother,
yep,
co-founded Moz, which is actually really well known in this area as being one of the first, like, SEO sort of internet marketing, like, thought leaders, really.
It really was, yeah. It used to be SEO Moz, for those of you who haven't been keeping track, and it's now Moz. And that's run by my eldest brother, Rand Fishkin. And my mother left a few years ago, but Rand's still there and he's still in charge. And he does it with Sarah Bird, who is the CEO.
Awesome. And now when at family gatherings, do they talk about your Bebe prediction and how they should have bought? That's like my family would do.
No. No, it's usually more about other people's successes rather than reminding my mother of the time she could have been a millionaire. That's, you know, a little taboo. I pull it out to impress people, which is standing near me. So we go out and we do all of these fun things, right? And, you know, I've gone to startup weekends and I've gone to events and I do these women presentation things. And I'm always standing next to my mother and they're like, oh, you're Jillian from Moz. And I always feel really terrible. And so I tell that story to make myself look better. I'm like, hey, I'm somebody to pay attention. Hello. Hi, I'm human. You know, I'm not just her baggage carrier.
I just love that you, first of all, just even said that. But even if it, you know, admitted that, just hilarious. And you're just like, I'm cool too. Like, my mom's not the only cool one. And I came out of her.
Actually, it's I do work with my mother, and it's the best high ever. She left Moz and she started Outlines Venture.
Mm-hmm.
And they are not a venture capital company. What they do is they invest time and interest preferentially to women companies, and then they invest money. So mm-hmm. they're really sure you're going to succeed before you see a dime from them.
Mm-hmm.
And she does it with a woman named Ann Kennedy, who did great things in other industries, and she's in Portland. And every once in a while, they call me in and they go, hey, could you tell us about this company? Hey, pivot that company. They need some marketing help. And working with my mom is just the most amazing thing.
Yeah. Yeah. She's like, I will never underestimate you ever again.
It actually happened a couple times. So she can tell you all the horror stories herself. Once she gets started, she, you know, predicts, she goes, Meredith did this and Meredith did that. And I just really have to start listening to my daughter.
That's awesome. Okay, well, so now back to you and your very interesting, I don't even say career, but skill set. It's very unique skill set. Tell me how, ways in which people, like everyday people, because not everybody understands the Duwamish, and like maybe it definitely affects us, but maybe it's something a little bit closer to home, like taxes.
So, yeah, let's pick a slightly more common issue. So, even if you don't smoke, I'm sure you've seen that cigarettes are just extensively priced these days.
Well, yeah, they used to be like $2
right.
to buy a pack of cigarettes. Now it's like $10.
Actually, the average in Washington State is $9.30.
Okay.
Which means that there's a direct tax or sales tax of $3.25. I don't know why the half a cent, but it's like gas. But what you don't see is there's actually an excise tax on smoked tobacco products.
Okay. So what does that mean? That's in addition to sales tax? That's
in addition to sales tax, an excise tax is a tax that's placed on the manufacturers and the transporting distributors. And that total tax is about $5 a pack. So you're really just mostly paying taxes when you buy cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
And here in Washington, which I'm sure your viewers know you announce out of, it's illegal to smoke marijuana here. We can actually go out to a pot store and just recreationally buy marijuana. And if you look closely, you'll actually notice that you're paying more in taxes for marijuana you smoke than for marijuana you eat.
Really?
Right. And you must wonder, right? Why? If they're making $5 a pack off you, would the U.S. government want you to stop smoking, whether it's marijuana or cigarettes?
Mm-hmm.
And the truth is that they're not making money.
Okay.
So here's how it goes. Let's just look at secondhand smoke, because a smoker picks up a pack of cigarettes and If you're in Canada, it says you're going to die. And if you are in England, it says this product will kill you and your children. And if you're here in the U.S., it says Surgeon General warning something, something, couldn't really manage that. But we all know it's going to, you know, theoretically kill us or cause birth defects. So here's the deal. Secondhand smoke causes 42,000 deaths among non-smoking adults every year. The total annual cost of secondhand smoke exposure is estimated at $5 billion for direct costs and $6 billion for indirect cost. A direct cost is cancer treatment. An indirect cost is paying you to stay home because you're that sick.
Okay.
Right? That's $11 billion. That's a B, not an M, guys. That's a B.
Okay, so hold on. I need to just catch up here. The cost that now for people who get cancer... And then taking care of the people who get cancer from smoking.
From secondhand smoke.
Oh, from secondhand smoke.
Yeah, secondhand smoke. That's the guy who passes you in the street and breathes on you while he's smoking. Or more likely, somebody in your home smokes and you're exposed on a regular basis.
Okay.
And this is only a number for adults. We haven't talked about kids who are much more susceptible.
Okay.
Okay, and here's the problem. Smoking, it doesn't matter whether you're lighting up a cigarette or a joint or you're standing over a fire pit and inhaling deeply. It's all bad for you.
Really?
It's true. Don't inhale deeply while standing over your fire pit. Stand back with a stick and roast your marshmallow that way. It's safer, it's a lot cooler, and you don't burn the marshmallows easily.
Okay.
But you also won't get smoke inhalation.
Okay. So the smoke inhalation is worse than, like, the chemicals in the cigarettes?
Absolutely.
Really?
So chewing tobacco or eating marijuana, I don't know what you would do with wood, but... yeah, it's actually a lot better for you.
Okay.
And
what was the billion? It's $11
billion. $11 billion is kind of a hard number to get your head around, right?
Yes.
So let's get a little bit easier. There's a publication from an Indiana university who does a lot of medical research. And they picked a county in Indiana for secondhand smoke. It was estimated at $53.9 million in 2000. Or $62.87 per person.
Okay.
So I'll give you all of the stuff and you can post it online so that people can see that we're not just making up numbers.
Okay.
But at $62 a person, it's actually kind of high, especially because all of us aren't smoking. Mm-hmm. In fact, the people we're talking about aren't smoking at all.
And so, $62 per person of all people in the United States?
Of all people in the United... This specifically was just a county that they did a study on.
Okay.
Right. And $11 billion is the secondhand smoke number. So $62 per person in this county where they were exposed to secondhand smoke.
Yeah.
And $11 billion in the U.S. is spent on it annually. So for those of you who know that there are a lot more people than that in the U.S., closer to 324 million, the total number, if you estimated from the county, would be closer to $20 billion. Mm-hmm. So it's a little high in that county. Or we could just say that maybe it's the 2016 versus 2010 numbers or something weird. But it's an staggering amount of money. And if the government just walked up to you and said, hey, don't stand around people who smoke. Here's $62 a year. I would make it an active event not to stand near people who smoked. Mm-hmm. And I think that we could use the $62 on a lot better things.
Okay, right? So the tax is... Okay, so let me just figure out how this works. The government actually has to pay $11 billion per year to take care of. In what way are they taking care of these people?
So they're taking care of people whose medical coverage has run out.
Okay.
Or they're taking care of people who are on permanent disability. The U.S. government pays for permanent disability. It's the kind of the loss of revenue, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you go home and you break your leg, that's one thing. But if you fall and you get a spinal injury and you can't work, the government pays you. It's the same thing if you get your voice removed, especially for a radio show host. That ends your career, mm-hmm. right? You can't, or at least it would be really funny, if you did your show through a voice box. I can't do a robot impersonation, but it would be a perfect time for it. it's this huge expense that gets paid, and the medical expenses run from, you know, actual treatment to emphysema care, infants who have just small weight or are premature due to secondhand smoke inhalation, who have underdeveloped lungs, And then there's this other cost that we don't talk about when we talk about health insurance. It's the cost of somebody to come over to your house and help you clean your house, make sure you're eating, make sure you're getting a bath, picking up your groceries for you. All of these little things that you think of as your normal day that when you're really ill, you can't do for yourself.
Mm-hmm. And so, okay, so now let's bring us back to what you do. You go and you research something, you know, you research some of this information and then to help figure out maybe what would be the tax that it should be kind of idea.
So if I was hired by the government, yeah, that's exactly what I'd do. I'd let my fingers do the walking. I'm not going to run a study. But kind of like you, I don't want to actually get that far into it. So I literally just take other people's research, mm-hmm. like you would in a pitch, and you'd say, here's the biggest number, now let's make it relatable, and move on.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd start with indirect costs of secondhand smoke, direct costs of secondhand smoke, and then I'd get into the cost of smoking, right? So deterioration of the human. And then there's this kind of the second part that we don't really talk about when we talk about the ability to predict costs. When it comes to the lower end, which we talk about insurance costs, the cost of a raised insurance. If you have 50 accidents, your car insurance is going up.
Mm-hmm.
In something like smoking, it's going to be the loss of revenue for the entire United States.
Because those people aren't working?
Because those people aren't working. And they're not stupid people. Right? An addiction doesn't mean that you're an idiot. It just means that you got a hold of something and you're hooked.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so those people have knowledge and skills and strengths that the rest of us don't have. And we need those skills and that knowledge. And we're going to have to find a way to replace it. So we're talking about training the new person to do it 10 to 15 years earlier. We're talking about losing the knowledge, the information, the revenue. And we're talking about how it affects other people. The worst thing about cancer isn't that I'm sick or you're sick.
Mm-hmm.
The worst thing about cancer is how it affects everyone else in our lives. Right? It's the people you live with. It's your friends. It's the people who have to pick up after you.
Okay. And their loss of work also.
Their loss of work and the quality of life.
Mm-hmm. Right?
So quality of life actually has a financial figure around it. And you can go research that on Google. They will tell you how the quality of your life is priced by the U.S. government.
Wow, really?
Yeah, the European government has one too, and they'll tell you about the price of quality of life. It includes things here in Seattle. We were the first to get a therapist on our quality of life quotient.
Really?
Yeah, so your quality of life standard includes the cost for a therapy session once a week with a therapist.
Okay. All right. So now I'm a startup and mm-hmm. I'm having you on my team. Like, what the heck? Like, I'm like, you know, what is the question I ask somebody like you?
So I've done everything from startup pitches, which are 30-second pitches, and I spend about 15 minutes chatting with you about your idea, and then I tell you a really good statistic that we find online to go out and figure out how to say this, right? Hi, I'd like to build an app. I think it's going to save 37,000 people a year because grandma doesn't want to wear the button on her chest, but this way we can put it on her phone and it's just a single tap.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now grandma and grandpa are cool, but they also have a life-saving application on their phone. And it's not grandma and grandpa who have to download it. It's, you know, their kids or their grandkids who are going to do it for them. I've worked with an LGBT company. I help them market their products and their interests. They make underwear. That was a really fun one.
Mm-hmm.
It was how to sell underwear for such a niche community. Obviously, you can't sell it on Amazon. Who would buy it, right? It's a large target audience, and what you have to do is continue to narrow your audience down
mm-hmm.
until you find exactly the right places to go and how to market and how to voice that in a way that's kind of nice because we're talking about underwear,
mm-hmm.
right? So it's about being edgy enough and PC enough to market something that's unusual there. I'm also working with a prolific author. She self-published her book on Amazon, signed a whole bunch of stuff that said she couldn't publish it in other places electronically, and then the book popped. She's the J.D. Salinger of the cannabis generation,
mm-hmm.
and we had to find alternative ways to sell her book and get people into Amazon to buy it in a really kind of interesting niche market as well. So I work with...
What do you... So I'm just going to interrupt you for a second. Because, to say that you're bringing marketing skills to the table, I mean, sure. But what does your specific, futurist, what does that bring to the table to these companies?
It's a very specific set of marketing. I'm not going to build you a flyer. I mean, I could, but anybody can build you a flyer. You can do it for yourself. What I'm going to tell you is who needs to know about your product, right? So it's not just... marketing in a traditional sense, it's target marketing with a different view on how your product can be related to other people and how they'll see you if you market yourself in a specific way and to a specific group. Mm-hmm. For example, this woman I'm helping with the book, she's in pot stores. It's a really strange place to stick a book, right?
Yeah.
Right. It's got a cat on it. There's literally a cat, half off a couch, just sleeping. And it just seems like such a strange group. But it's written in such a way that anybody who's high is going to love it.
Okay.
Or anybody who's only got 5 minutes to read a book, at a time, they can pick it up and put it down, and it's built for that kind of audience. She didn't write it for that kind of audience. She was writing for her family. It's about seeing a different way to help you with your products.
Mm-hmm. And make connections based on what you know about other groups of people.
Yes. Okay. And about larger groups of people, right? I'm not talking about your sister or your mother. I'm talking about a couple hundred thousand people at a time.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. And so are you like a graph person? Like, do you like to look at graphs?
I do, actually. I think it helps convey things really well.
Yeah. Do you, when you get ideas, do you see like graphs and diagrams, or do you, how do your ideas come to you?
So they don't. I really wish that they did.
okay.
But I have to admit to being kind of an accounting geek, actually. I think in terms of spreadsheets, which just sounds terrible and awful and like you've hired an accountant or a tax manager or something. But what I do before I talk to you is work out that graph, right? So I'll actually sit down and I'll go, I wonder how many pot stores there are in Seattle. I wonder how many of those people might read books. Okay, everybody reads books. Let's, And then I talk about price range and we figure out, statistically for an average number of pages and of that community, what's the, income range. And then I'll sit down and I'll build you a graph. But it comes to me in kind of crazy pieces. And it's kind of like a terrible looking spreadsheet when I think about it. And occasionally, really, really good ideas come to me in short YouTube graphics with the little stick figures. It's like, ooh, that giant group of people got a Venn diagram over here, and then we get to pull them that way. And so it populates that way, too, in my brain sometimes. But those are the really good ideas, and they're not an everyday idea.
Okay. And one of the things that I find is really fascinating is how you take a bunch of information, which, I can just imagine myself being like, great, numbers. not that I don't like numbers. I do like numbers, but I'm taking the numbers and putting them into a graph and then putting them into some presentation. Like, there's a lot of steps there.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you connect numbers to persuasion?
So I see the problem with that a lot in pitch decks, especially for somebody who is just starting out, even if they've pitched before. And what I like to tell people is tell a story with your numbers.
Mm-hmm.
So you start out with a really big number, like the total market for toys in the world is 75 billion. Who knows? But, you pick a giant number. And it's kind of that shocking big number that nobody can relate to. And then you build it down. And you go, what really makes up that number? And you work your way through with your pitch deck or your presentation or whatever you need to make it a relatable number. There's a show called Bullshit by Penn and Teller. And they did this great thing about numbers. They had M&Ms. And Penn went through and he says, one M&M, two, okay, I can get three around my head. When I get to about five or six, he said he kind of lost the concept. Right. When we talk about money, you can think actually in about $10,000 to $20,000. It's about the price of buying a new car.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's also about the amount that most people have in their savings account. And that equates to X number of months saved. So you can think that high. But really, I talk about how to make numbers relatable, how to keep them in your stories, how to bring a number down to a reasonable amount, and then remember also that you've got this giant number as well that you could work with.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I've heard that one of the, you know, I've talked to lots of different people who hear pitches all the time. Mm-hmm. And then what they say, what I've heard that they say is they don't like when people say, this is this market, which is, you know, $10 billion. And if we just capture 2% of that market, we'll be successful.
That's very true, because it's a lie, right? There's a great book called Lying with Statistics, and I'm sure everybody who's heard a pitch has read this book because they know it's a lie.
Yeah.
Right? There's no way you're going to capture 2% of the toy industry. That's Lego. I mean, those guys have billions of dollars out. They've got a proprietary product. They've been around for like 45 years, maybe longer, who knows. And it's actually 75. I think I saw that at the Puget Sound Museum. But it's an impossible number to get to. And the reason you know it's an impossible number is because there's no basis for it.
Okay, what's that mean?
So you pick a toy industry and you say, you know, it's $75 billion, whatever. That doesn't mean that it's your toy industry. That doesn't mean that it's your target market, right? Mm-hmm. If you build a toy, it's not for ages 0 to 5,000. It's for, you know, 6 to 8 year olds, 10 to 20 year olds. Monopoly got really good with, I think it's like 12 to, you know, whoever you want to be. But there is a range and there's a market. And people who are looking for a pitch deck are looking for a return on their funds. And if you give them a giant number, they're going to know it's not a reasonable, obtainable goal, and they're going to not believe any of the rest of your numbers.
Yeah.
So if you were to say, okay, $75 billion is the toy, you know, industry, of which the age range is, you know, maybe $15 billion. In the U.S., that's only, you know, $87,000 in our age range with our gender in this market, and of that, 2% we can get. Now, look, the guy in the pitch deck, he doesn't want to know anything but that last piece.
Yeah.
Which is what you think you can get and the number right above it.
Okay.
Right? They want to know that you've done your research, that you've done your homework. And more than that, even if they're not going to pull out a calculator and do the math, they want to know that somehow you did the math or you have a source you can quote. And there's nothing wrong with doing a little bit of high school notation on your presentation by sticking a little number in the corner and putting down where you got the number at the bottom.
Okay. All right. So why don't you give us some advice for anybody who's pitching? Because, you know, people could be pitching at a job interview, could be pitching at literally a pitch deck, or they could be pitching themselves on a date. So how about three pieces of advice that we could use to be more successful in our and more persuasive in our pitches?
So I think the best pitch I've ever heard was from my little brother, and he was pitching a Christmas present for the cat.
Awesome.
Example. So first off, I'd like to tell you, be interested in what you're pitching. Absolutely. If you're not passionate about what you're pitching for, they're going to notice. Second, make eye contact. Have good posture. I know this seems really weird, but you've only got about 5 seconds with the current generation of VCs to make a good impression. And here's the bad news. After the baby boomers, it drops to about 3 seconds.
Okay.
Eye contact, good posture, stand up straight, speak well, and dress for your audience. Right. And the third piece, brevity is a virtue. This one's really hard. Bullet points will kill you, but brevity is a virtue. So keep your slide deck fairly simple. Use colorful images. Go forward. Don't pack everything in so that you're scrambling over yourself and trying to speak quickly. Pace yourself. Know what you're talking about. Be passionate. And give them something to be interested in. A story is a really good way to go through it. And make sure that when you're speaking, you don't speak to the ground.
head up. Yes. All right. Well, thank you so much for being here today. I learned a lot, and I find what you're doing so fascinating.
Thanks, Jen. I really appreciate coming.
Yeah, and thank you for tuning in to Radically Distinct Radio. This has been Jen Morgan.
Are you really good at what you do, but kind of awkward and uneasy when it comes to self-promotion? Maybe you struggle to find the right words or fear coming across as an imposter. A radically distinct personal brand strategy clarifies the unique value you offer and gives you the confidence and courage to share your message with the world. Go to jenmorgan.com to learn about Jen's upcoming 2-day personal brand workshop. That's Jen with two N's, morgan.com. Registration is limited to 10 participants. Act now.